For the most part, people who study the things at the bottom of the screen, like brains and astrocytes and neurons, don't tend to study the things at the top of the screen, like the development of listening and writing and reading skills. But today, I'm going to blur those boundaries a little bit and talk about some of my ERP studies of children, brains, and reading. The question that's been guiding my research for the past few years is what happens in the brain as children learn how to read. So for the most part, children entering first grade don't know how to read, and by the end of that first grade year, the majority of children do have at least the basics of reading down. And that's a pretty amazing developmental sequence. In just 1 year, you develop the ability to look at what are essentially random marks on a page and get meaning from those marks on the page. Clearly, something must be happening in the brain to allow for the development of this ability. So put another way, the question is, how do neurocognitive reading systems develop? And that's a really, really complex question. So I'm going to break it down into some sub-questions that we'll address today. First, we're going to take a look at the psycholinguistic theory based on behavioral data. So there are decades and decades of behavioral research on how children learn how to read, how best to teach children to learn how to read, and that information should, of course, inform any brain studies of learning to read. Second, what can electrophysiological methods reveal about the development of reading systems? So can you use electrophysiological methods, and specifically the recording of ERPs, to look at the developing language and reading systems? First, can you even get ERP data from wiggly 5 to 8 year olds? And that's not a small question. That's really a difficult issue in this kind of research. And second, are ERPs going to be sensitive to the types of processes that we want to look at in developing readers? Third, what can theories of atypical language and reading contribute? So often when you look at how a system breaks down or develops in an atypical manner, that can give you some clues about the development of the typically developing system. So first questions first, the psycholinguistic theory behind learning to read. There are about as many theories of learning to read as there are theorists of learning to read. So I'm just going to sort of focus on probably what the majority of theorists would agree on are the important components of learning to read. First, beginning readers need to master the orthography of the language. That is, the visual features, the shapes of letters, which spelling patterns tend to co-occur in the language. They also need to master the phonology of the language, the sounds of speech. And they've been hearing those for 5 or 6 years already, so they come with some pretty good abilities in phonology. And the idea of beginning readers is that you match the phonology that you know to the orthography that you're learning. So you map the visual to the auditory, grapheme to phoneme correspondences. And the goal of beginning reading, of learning to read, is that that process of mapping becomes automatic. That is fast, obligatory, autonomous, requiring only limited use of cognitive resources. And that allows for the overarching goal of reading, which is comprehension, getting meaning from the text in context. So if you're expending all the limited pool of resources on these lower level orthographic and phonological processes, you don't have anything left over for comprehension. So those are the big concepts in beginning reading. Turning now to language in the brain, what can event-related potentials tell us about what's going on in the reading brain? Recording event-related potentials is actually quite simple considering the neuroimaging methods that are out there. It doesn't require a multi-million dollar magnet, for example. So you need at least a willing subject, or at the very least a willing head. You place an electrode at the scalp, which is connected to an amplifier. And what you end up recording is the ongoing electrical activity in the brain, or the electroencephalogram, EEG. Just a recording of the electricity going on in the brain all the time. To get an ERP from the EEG, you simply present some sort of stimulus to your participant. And this can be visual stimulus, auditory stimulus, somatosensory stimulus, any sort of stimulus, and you time lock the presentation of that stimulus to certain portions of the EEG. So in our studies, we often use language stimuli, and I'll play some stimuli from our sentence paradigm for you. These are auditory sentences. So we present sentences within two conditions, so we have some comparison about how the brain processes the information. So a sentence from one condition might be something like this.
The babies won't drink the milk from their bottle.
The comparison condition might be something like this.
The babies won't drink the songs from their bottle.
So a well-formed sentence versus a sentence with a semantic anomaly. And to get an ERP, you have to present many similar sentences.
Kate will plant the roses in her garden.
And so on and so forth, and at some point in time, you always have the matched pair for the comparison.
Kate will plant the babies in her garden.
So this is why we don't really get good six-year-old data, because they're a bunch of giggle pusses, and whenever you move, it ruins the ERP data, and they really think that these sentences are the funniest thing they've ever heard. To analyze the ERP data, you simply look at all the instances of the right word in context and average across the EEG that occurred just as the right word was played in context. And you plot that data in terms of time, which is on a scale of milliseconds, and amplitude on a scale of microvolts. So for the right words in context, you might get an ERP, a potential directly related to the event of the right word in the right context. And then you go back and do the same thing for your comparison condition. Average across all the instances of the semantic anomalies, plot the data, and what you end up with in this case is known as an N400. It's a negative going peak in the waveform. Negative is plotted up for no particular reason. And it's maximal at about 400 milliseconds after stimulus presentation. You can see that the two conditions diverge a little bit before 300 milliseconds here. So within 300 milliseconds, the brain has already recognized the difference between the right word in context and the wrong word in context. And that's important because that's pretty good temporal sensitivity in a method. And if you want to look at automaticity, which is key to developing reading skills, you need a method that lets you look at time on the scale of milliseconds. And ERPs can do that. So when we record ERPs, we actually record not just from that one electrode placed at the scalp, we record from many electrodes sewn into a stretchy elastic cap, an electrocap. And this works, luckily, with children of all ages. So we have electrodes arrayed across the scalp, and because we're interested in language issues, we have higher density of electrodes over language areas. And you can arrange the electrodes any way you want to, depending on your question. So you might have seen ERP data plotted a little bit differently. That is the voltage at each electrode site at a given point in time. So if we wanted to look at another representation of the N400, we could say, what's happening at each electrode site at 400 milliseconds? Let's plot the voltage. And what you end up with is a nice pretty picture that looks something like this. There's a negativity along the purple end of the scale across the back of the head that's bilateral. So this is just another view of the N400. Can you use this method to look at the development of reading-related neurocognitive systems? Well, luckily you can, because I got a qualifying paper out of it. I actually used this N400 component of the ERP waveform with children who were good readers. Now, the theory of the N400 is that it's an index of a higher level integration process. So it takes as its input the products of those lower level processes like orthography and phonology. In adults, many studies have shown that only orthographically and phonologically legal stimuli will elicit an N-400. So only the strings that could be possible words or are real words will elicit this N-400 response. In children, it was unclear. There was virtually no research out there looking at the N-400 in children. So what I did for my qualifying paper was looked at quote-unquote fluent single-word readers. These were 10 and 11-year-olds who were at or above grade level in reading. And I used some pretty simple stimuli that varied on the dimensions that we were most interested in, orthography and phonology. So the stimuli looked something like this. We had real words, which were legal in terms of orthography, phonology, and semantics, so a word like grapes. We had pseudo words, which were basically made up words, which were legal in terms of orthography and phonology, but they just didn't happen to have any semantics attached to them. They didn't have a meaning. Letter strings, which were orthographically legal in the sense that they were made up of real letters, but they were phonologically and semantically illegal, so you couldn't pronounce them, and certainly they had no meaning. And finally, false fonts, which looked something like this, but not really, which were strings of letter-like symbols, which were illegal across the board. Not the right orthography, not the right phonology, certainly no semantics. And finally, we had the category animal names, which were legal across the board, and were put in just so kids had something to do. So they looked at each stimulus as it appeared at the middle of the screen, and they were asked to press a button whenever they saw an animal name. Based on the adult data, what we expected was an N-400 to just words and pseudo-words, just the orthographically and phonologically legal stimuli. So the paradigm looks something like this, rather boring. The ERP data for adults, and this was actually became the data for Lisa Marin's honors thesis at Tufts University, was pretty much as expected. We had that negative peak, maximal about 400 milliseconds, to the legal stimuli, the words and pseudo-words, and the illegal stimuli, you can see, were clearly differentiated from those legal stimuli. Guesses for our 10 and 11-year-old fluent readers. At or above grade level in reading. What do you think? Same? Different?
Later?
Other guesses?
Reversed?
Other guesses? Let's take a look. We have an N-400 to all types of stimuli, both the legal and the illegal strings. So, both illegal and legal strings in these at or above grade level reading 10 and 11-year-olds elicit an N-400.
How about the deviations? Presumably, as means, the kids react to all four identically.
Mm-hmm. But it's not identical. It's not identical. In the 200 to 400 millisecond window, they look identical. If you take 400 to 600, if you split that N-400 into early and late, they have differentiated in the last part of the N-400.
Well, what I was asking was simply, is this what you get because you're 10 or 11, or because you have some kids are being just like adults and some kids are like adults?
This is a good question. We had no behavioral data on these kids, but the next study we did. Okay. So the question was, is it because they're 10 and 11, or because some are reading like adults and some are not reading like adults? So this pattern suggests that the developing neurocognitive language system is actually more open to linguistic possibility. So all sorts of letter strings are eligible for word processing in this developing system. And of course, the other side of that is that the system is less accurate at selecting potentially meaningful candidates for word processing. This brings into question the idea, based on behavioral data and many, many years of behavioral studies, that there's fluency in reading simple decontextualized words by the third or fourth grade. So certainly behaviorally, these kids looked adult-like. But when you looked at what was going on in their brains, something very different was happening than what was happening in the adults.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So for the next studies, when you have behavioral data, do you differentiate in their performance between, so the brain looks the same, but do they differentiate in, you know, their accuracy and weight? So they're four different sound types?
Because we have the category of animal names in there that they need to press the button to, the only accuracy data that we have is button press data. And because children tend to press the button rather vigorously when they see a target, we have no brain data to go with that because they move so much that it wipes out the ERP data. For this next study, I actually have the behavioral data, the accuracy data, and we can take a look at that. So at this point in time, at the end of the qualifying paper phase, I could either have gone later to see when does the system look adult-like in terms of brains, or I could go earlier and say, I've jumped in the middle of the story here. I need to go back to the beginning of the story and see how this system develops. So it would have been easier to go to adolescents because they can sit still and follow directions, but of course I chose to go to first graders. So this is a study of the N400 in beginning readers with first grade girls. And the idea here is if the N400 is an index of a higher level integration process and beginning readers have not yet automatized the contributing lower level processes, what are the waveforms going to look like? And this time, as I've said, we got some behavioral data from the Woodcock Reading Mastery Test. The stimuli were very similar, just have different names this time. Known words that were real words, readable and familiar to the average first grader, so word like doll. Unknown words, which are basically pseudo words for first graders. Real words that were readable but not familiar, so words like lol. Difficult words that were not readable, words like doubt. Non-words, which were simply letter strings once again. And that animal names category, just to keep them interested. So behaviorally, in post-testing, 99% of the known words and 97% of the animal names were read correctly by all of the children. So these were pretty good readers, and the design was such that they were able to read what they were meant to be able to read. ERP-wise, we see this familiar pattern once again. All sorts of stimuli elicit an N400. But this time, we have that behavioral data, and we did a median split into the high ability, quote unquote, and low ability reading groups. The low ability reading group was actually reading at grade level 2.9. So these are first graders. This is what you get for testing in Cambridge. So they were pretty good readers, but they weren't at the level of automaticity as proposed by behavioral studies. They weren't at that third or fourth grade level of reading. Our high ability readers were absolutely ridiculous. They were reading on average at grade level 4.9, and on the word attack subtest of the Woodcock, they were reading almost at the eighth grade level. And this is important because the word attack subtest is a pseudo word reading task. So it taps those orthographic and phonological abilities. There's only one way to do that task, and that's to sound out the words, map the orthography to the phonology. So this incredibly high score suggests that these kids probably had automatized those lower level processes. So by luck, in this first grade sample, we actually have some kids that the behavioral data suggests have automatized and some kids who have not.
How did your sample play out in terms of numbers? So you have 10 girls.
I have 14 altogether, tested 20, decent data from 14, so there's 7 in each of these groups.
Okay. Great.
The groups actually are significantly different on reading scores.
Do you have a standard score for their reading ability?
I do in the paper, but I don't remember it.
Okay. Right.
So looking at the brain waves, what do we see? First, for the known words. For the high-ability readers, we have a lovely and rather large N400, a very well-defined peak. For the low-ability readers, not much activity in the N400 time window at all. It sort of goes up and just levels off. Not a peak, certainly, in ERP speak. For the unknown words, we see the same pattern. For the difficult words and non-words, same pattern across the board. We have a lovely, well-defined peak for our high-ability readers and not much N400 activity for our low-ability readers. So this is consistent with the hypothesis that those high-ability readers were actually reading with automaticity of those lower-level processes, as the behavioral data suggested. They show the same pattern of being more open to linguistic possibility. All sorts of strings are going through the word processing system. And actually, when you think about it, this is a pretty good learning mechanism to let in all sorts of strings in the beginning and then narrow down as you have more and more experience with reading. And this is actually the sort of mechanism that's built into a lot of connectionist models for reading. The low-ability readers, on the other hand, seem to be reading without automaticity of the lower-level processes, which would mean that they were exhausting limited neurocognitive resources, and that's why we didn't see the N400. There were no resources left over for that high-level integration process. It would also mean that reading was a qualitatively different process for these low-ability readers versus the high-ability readers. So when we're talking about reading, maybe we need to be a little more careful, especially when we're talking about beginning readers. So a summary of where we've been for these N400 studies. In adults, only words and pseudo-words elicit an N400, only legal stimuli. In 10 and 11-year-olds, we find words, pseudo-words, letter strings, and false fonts all elicit N400 activity. In 6 and 7-year-olds, for poorer readers, we see little N400 activity. And for better readers, we see N400s to all sorts of stimuli. So the N400 reflects the selectivity of the word processing system overall. And even more exciting, the N400 may actually serve as a kind of oblique index of the automaticity of those lower-level processes.
Question. About how long is the session?
About 35 minutes with breaks.
I'm just wondering whether you ever looked at the first half of the stimuli versus the second half of the stimuli to see whether there was kind of a filtering pattern.
Mm-hmm. I didn't do a split of the stimuli there.
I'd be very interested to see, for example. I mean, it strikes me as sort of a common sense level. At a certain point, you begin to ignore, especially the false fonts, which are so far away. But I just don't know how long 30 minutes with the break is for a second. I think if you could easily do a split first versus the second half.
Yeah. Technically, it's really difficult to do a split with ERP data with kids. We have so many stimuli, we present so many stimuli because we lose so many trials due to wiggling and blinks and all of this other stuff that sort of creates electrical activity that gets in the way of the ERP you actually want to record.
Well, you could do a dumb split, meaning just to see whether there's anything there.
I'm afraid we wouldn't have enough trials to average to get a decent ERP. So around 30 trials we had on average for each of the conditions. And looking at a 15, you know, if it happens that there were 15 in the first half and 15 in the second half, looking at a 15 trial average ERP is not going to tell you much. It's going to be very noisy and not reliable. So, yeah, I wish I could do that. I wish I could sit them down for an hour and get lots and lots of trials and do all these sorts of manipulations. But I think it's a limitation of the method that you really can't do that with kid data, unfortunately.
Was the WRMT done on the same day?
Yes.
Within that 35-minute period? Or
no, before. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see any differences in their attention span through that data?
No. No. We did the word attack, word ID, and letter ID subtests, and it was very quick, very quick.
And each child was just tested once?
Yes. Yes.
I know ERP doesn't give good localization information, but do you have any information about, you know, whether it starts at one, you know, left versus right or occipital?
No, it had that bilateral posterior distribution that you see in adults. This was 16-channel data, so I wouldn't want to say anything about whether it was more parietal, more occipital. You really can't get that spatial information unless you have a high-density electrode cap, and 16 is not high. Other questions? Yeah, I've moved up to 32 now. I think people are generally comfortable 128 and 256 can give you good spatial data. So
with kids,
you can't have them sit as long as it takes to get that cap on and get each electrode fixed to work right. Yeah, we're pushing it with 32. That's about a half an hour of application time. Other questions, comments? So it suggests the N400 may index, sort of in a backhanded way, the automaticity of these lower-level processes. But what about those lower-level processes themselves? What do we know about the development of those in terms of ERPs? Revisiting psycholinguistic theory, looking at theories of atypical language and reading development, can give us some clues on where to look to unpack those ideas of orthography and phonology. So once again, as in reading, there are multiple theories of what goes wrong in dyslexia and specific language impairment, or SLI. And I'm just going to target a few of those. These aren't the major ones in all cases, but they give us some clues on where to look. So dyslexia, which has been in the past called word blindness, may actually involve a specific visual system deficit, particularly in the magnocellular or motion processing system. And behavioral studies have shown, indeed, that sensitivity to motion is related to orthographic processing skills. So there's a connection between the motion system and orthography. SLI, according to some theories, involves a temporal processing deficit, especially for auditory information, but also for other information, particularly the inability to integrate rapidly changing brief acoustic events. Well, what's a rapidly changing brief acoustic event? Speech, for example. Sensitivity to frequency modulations, which is one of the aspects of speech, has been related in behavioral studies to phonological skills. So there's a link between that fast temporal auditory processing and phonology. And for both SLI and dyslexia, it's been proposed that the core deficit is phonological in nature. And there have been a lot of studies that have shown that any kind of non-word repetition task or any kind of task that asks children to manipulate phonemes, even silly things like Pig Latin tasks, will reveal a phonological deficit in SLI and dyslexia. So this gives us some clues on where to look to get a better handle on these ideas of orthography and phonology. So what do we know about the development of those sensory systems? What do we know about the development of the motion system or fast auditory temporal processing system in kids who are learning how to read? Well, it turns out we know virtually nothing because there are no ERP studies out there looking at these processes in 6 to 8 year olds or 5 to 8 year olds. So that's where I've been spending my last few years of my postdoc, research with 6 to 8 year old children, trying to investigate what's happening in these lower level processes in terms of ERP development. So we have numerous paradigms, some of which look at basic visual processing to try to get at orthography. We have a visual refractory period paradigm, and all that gets at is whenever a neuron fires, it can't fire again right away. It has a recovery cycle, a recharge period, and that's the refractory period. And we're simply looking at that in children versus adults. Is it longer in children? Is it shorter in children? We also have a motion versus color processing paradigm. So we saw that one of the theories of dyslexia is that the motion system particularly is implicated. In terms of basic auditory processing, trying to get at the idea of phonology, we have mismatched negativity paradigms, which I'll talk about in a moment. An auditory refractory period paradigm, same concept as the visual one, sort of a matching paradigm, and a non-word auditory line paradigm. And we've also subjected these children to some higher level processing paradigms, looking at those sentences that I played for you earlier. We have an attention paradigm, and we did some pretty extensive behavioral testing with these kids as well. So this was a major, major project. Each child came for 4 visits to the lab. Each visit was about 3 hours long. So these kids were really put through their paces, but took a lot of breaks. These kids were tired, took a walk, had a snack, and they did really well. We didn't have one child who quit in the middle of anything. And this was about 105 kids that we ran. So got some very good data today. I'm going to talk about the motion versus color processing paradigm data, because we saw that motion is implicated in dyslexia. Talk about the mismatch negativity paradigms, because they index fast temporal processing, which we saw might be implicated in SLI. And talk about the non-word auditory rhyme paradigm, because this really gets at phonology. There are 2 separate visual processing streams in the brain. The first is the magnocellular or dorsal system, which travels up through the posterior parietal areas. The most famous member is MT. This processes information about motion, stimuli with low spatial frequency and low contrast. And this is the one that's sort of been suggested might be atypical in dyslexics in fMRI studies with adults, and also quite a few behavioral studies with adults. The other system is the parvocellular or ventral system, which travels down through regions of the inferior temporal lobe, including V4 for color processing. And this system specializes in processing stimuli with color, high spatial frequency, high contrast, texture, pattern, form. So before I went out to Helen Neville's lab in Oregon, she had developed a set of stimuli that were designed to tap either the parvocellular or the magnocellular system. And the paradigm was pretty complex, and it was clear it wasn't going to be able to be used with children, but I borrowed those stimuli and sort of did some adapting for use with children. So this is sort of a cartoon of the color stimulus, and maybe you can tell which part was changed for use with children. So we really don't care about the Pooh characters, but we've put them in there for kids to press a button whenever they see a character from Pooh. So simply the task is to look at the center of the screen and press a button whenever you see a Pooh character. But what we're really interested in is each change of color we're recording in ERP2. So we get information about the color processing system. And then, of course, we have the motion processing stimulus. Still makes me smile. I've seen it like 105 times, but I really like this. So looking at the ERP data, previous studies have suggested that the P1 component, the first positivity in the waveform, indexes primarily parvocellular activity, or the color processing system. And in adults that we ran in this kid paradigm, we find that the first positivity is indeed larger to the P stimuli. So that red line there for the color processing system, the peak is larger down towards the bottom of the screen, positive peak for the color stimuli. What do we see in our 6, 7, and 8-year-olds? We actually see a very similar pattern. The peak is larger to the color stimuli. So our index of color processing shows little evidence of developmental change when you look at the response of color versus motion. Clearly, there's other developmental things going on. The size of the waveforms and the timing of the waveforms are certainly developing. But when you're looking at motion versus color response, see the same pattern in kids as we do in adults. On the other hand, the N1 is thought to index primarily magnocellular activity, so motion processing. And in our adults, we find that the N1 is earlier to M stimuli. So the black line there is shifted temporally to the left as compared to the red line. What do we see in our 6, 7, and 8-year-olds? We see something very different. We see that the N1 is earliest to the color stimuli, and in fact, we really don't see a well-defined response to the motion stimuli at all. So our index of motion processing does show developmental change, which is consistent with the idea that this system may be implicated in difficulties in learning to read, because it certainly is still developing across the learning to read age range.
My impression from the examples you showed was that the motion stimuli were subtler than
They're low contrast,
right.
Which taps specifically that magnocellular system, which taps MT.
So that's on purpose.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, all of the characteristics of the stimuli were developed and put together based on what's known about the specialization of the magno system versus the parvo system.
But if it's based on, if that norming is based on adults, I think what Kurt's implying is it may not be a good measure of the system.
The behavioral paradigms that are used, random dot type things, format of motion type paradigms, do work with children in a similar way as they work in adults. So behavioral studies have suggested the same sorts of tasks can be used to tap these processes in adults and children. And I can't think of any evidence to suggest that at the level of these basic visual processing systems, that there would be a development in terms of what kind of stimuli the system responds to. So many of the characteristics of the stimulus are designed to tap anatomical differences in the types of neurons in these systems. So the magno cells respond to different types of things than the parvo cells in the parvocellular system.
So behaviorally, in the motion one, the kids are in fact performing adequately, even though they don't seem to be responding electrophysiologically.
Kids are right. Brain
dying.
Yeah. 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 You have the same thing that we saw before, that brain behavior split.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Short-term memory deficit. So turning now to fast auditory processing, the mismatch negativity paradigms. The mismatch negativity is elicited when there's an occasional deviant sound in a series of standard sounds. So you might have beep, 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 boop, beep, 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 and the deviant will elicit a specific ERP response. And all it is a more negative waveform in the window of about 100 to 300, 100, 400 milliseconds. So that's known as the mismatch negativity, or the MMN. A number of studies have suggested that there is no developmental course to the MMN, that it looks the same in newborns as it does in old age. A few studies have suggested that the size or presence of the MMN is related to reading, and there are just as many studies which have found no relation between reading and the MMN at all. We had two MMN paradigms. In the first, we used speech sounds and looked at this phenomenon of categorical perception. So in one condition, we had exemplars of a phoneme within a category, so staying within one category. And in the other condition, we had exemplars of phonemes that crossed a category boundary. And we're going to look at these stimuli in just a second to make that a little more clear. In the second MMN paradigm, we used non-speech sounds, which were basically just frequency-modulated sounds. So here's the speech stimuli. The within-category condition, we used the phoneme ka with 40 milliseconds voice onset time as a standard, and the phoneme ka with 80 milliseconds voice onset time as a deviant. So I'll play two strings of stimuli for you. In each string, there's one deviant, so see if you can hear it. Sounds like ta and da to me, but okay. Those are both ka's, and you could hear just a little bit of slurring for the deviant. So you can pick it out, but they're both within the same category perceptually. On the other hand, the between category stimuli, we used Ka with 50 milliseconds voice onset time for the standard and Ka with 10 milliseconds voice onset time for the deviant. And when you shorten it that much, for most people, perceptually, that switches into the category of Ga versus Ka. So in both cases, the difference is just 40 milliseconds of voicing, but only in the second case does that make the critical difference across the category boundary. So you can listen to those. So that deviant should be a little more easy to hear than the first deviant. What do the ERP waveforms look like to these types of speech stimuli? Well, in adults, when we look at the between category stimuli, we find that in the 100 to 300 millisecond window, the deviant, the red line, is more negative towards the top of the screen than the standard. That's your typical MMN, the deviant more negative than the standard in that time window. For our within category stimuli, find a very different pattern. From 100 to 300 milliseconds and a little bit beyond that, out to 400, we find that the standard is actually more negative than the deviant. So we have what we've been calling a mismatch positivity, in fact. So good evidence for differential processing between and within categories in adults with these stimuli. What do we see in children? Basically the exact same pattern. We get an MMN for the between category comparison and an MMP for the within category comparison.
Do you mind us the age?
These are 6 to 8.
The adults, are they
college students?
Okay, and they don't have any deficits?
No, they reported, the adults reported no visual or auditory problems, and the kids were actually tested for auditory and visual problems. So both within and between categories, speech sound mismatch elicits similar ERP mismatch effects in adults and 6 to 8 year old children. And we have evidence for categorical perception in both groups. So this is consistent with those studies that have found that there's very little developmental course to the MMN. We're seeing pretty similar data. It's not going to get much closer than that. But what about these non-speech stimuli? In both conditions here, the standard was an FM sweep with zero modulation, so no initial modulation. In one condition, the deviant had 40 milliseconds of initial modulation, and in the other condition, 200 milliseconds of initial modulation. So we can listen to those. This is a standard. This is 40 milliseconds modulation. So you can hear just a little bit wonkiness there at the beginning, and then you can really hear it here. So we're playing these at 70 dB. The paradigm lasts roughly 10 minutes. It's a lot of sounds to listen to, so we got some really nice data. They're watching a movie while they're doing this. They're told you can just ignore the sounds. This is an automatic response. You can get it without attention. They're not pressing a button to the deviant or anything. They're actually just watching a movie without sound while these sounds are playing in the background. Looking at the large difference, the 0 versus the 200 milliseconds initial modulation, in adults, we find in the 100 to 300 millisecond window, the deviant is certainly more negative than the standard. You have a nice MMN effect, and we also have this kind of late effect here that we don't know a whole lot about. We need to look into. Small, 0 versus 40, 100 to 300 milliseconds, we have that MMN effect again, the deviant more negative than the standard, and the late effect. And you can see that the size of the MMN is actually related to the size of the deviants. So for the smaller difference, there's a smaller MMN, and for the larger difference, there's a larger MMN. And this is consistent with previous MMN studies with adults, that the size of the effect varies with the size of the deviants. What do we see in our 6 to 8 year old kids? Something very different. We see a mismatch positivity, that the standard is actually more negative than deviant, followed by this sort of late effect. And we see the same thing for the small amount of deviants, an MMP followed by a late effect. and the size of the mismatch effect does not really seem to be related to the size of the deviant. So non-speech FM mismatch, at least using the paradigm that we used and the stimuli that we used, does not elicit similar ERP mismatch effects in adults and 6 to 8 year old children. So there is development of the fast temporal auditory processing system in the 6 to 8 year old age range. Surprisingly, it's just in the non-speech processing, not in the speech processing, at least for the stimuli and the paradigms that we used. Questions?
Yeah. Do you have any hypothesis why that is? Why that is? You would think that it would be the other way around for development.
You would. Do I have any hypothesis of why it is that way? At this point in time, no, we really don't have a good story about this. You would assume that the more complex processing would be the one to show the developmental progression. And we're not sure why this is.
Was there any difference? Because, I mean, I don't remember the exact curve that you showed before, but mm-hmm. Is there a difference between the non-speech for adults and the speech for adults?
There is a difference in the waveform, but it elicits an MMN in all cases except the within category. So looking at the between category where there really is a deviance looks very similar in terms of the MMN to the deviance here where there really is a deviance in both cases.
Yeah.
And the adult data is pretty consistent with what's out there that has studies that have used similar stimuli under similar circumstances. So... yeah, the kids stuff is a real surprise.
Do late effects show up in other studies too, or is that...
Occasionally there's a late effect and sometimes not. And from what I've read, it's a huge literature. The MMN literature is very large and it's very messy because there are just so many little things you can do to auditory stimuli to make it quite different perceptually. And then, you know, the waveform changes a lot based on some little change. So I have seen late effects before. I haven't seen a really good explanation of what they are, what they're indexing.
Can it be the same, I mean, studies I've seen doing this is when it's not automatized, it's the same process, but it goes a different pathway, and that makes it a late effect, like when the right brain takes over for the automacy in the visual cortex when reading, because the left brain can, then it gets the same effect, but it's a little later, not automatized. Can that have anything to do with the late effect?
It could have something to do with the late effect here, but because we're getting a deviance effect early, it's just not in the direction that we expected it to be.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that what we're getting in the same time window for our kids here and our adults here is reflecting the same early processes, and what we're getting in the late time window here and here is reflecting the same processes. So you're right, it could be that this somehow has shifted to be this in the kids, and this is who knows what. Yeah, it's very complicated, and we need to, this is not even, this is like in process right now. We need to really run some stats and do some comparisons and research what's in the literature out there that's directly related to this.
People that are starting to do research, I just like to highlight how this is like the first study in an area, and generally that makes it very difficult to interpret.
Yeah. And we didn't need to do so many conditions. This is another issue. When you're designing stuff, what do we want to compare? We wanted to make comparisons across speech and non-speech even, which, you know, I presented as, you know, here and here, speech and non-speech. But we have a difference of 40 milliseconds of timing here, which is the same as the difference that we had in both our speech conditions. It was 40 milliseconds of voicing. So we have another comparison across the two conditions here. So it's a really, really complex study in itself, beyond the fact that there's nothing else out there to sort of compare it to. Other questions? Okay. Turning now to phonological processing in terms of auditory rhyming. Lots and lots of studies have shown that rhyme awareness and the phonological memory skills required to do rhyming tasks are related to reading achievement and there's pretty good evidence that phonology is at the core of dyslexia, at least for some subset of dyslexics. To do an auditory rhyming task where you're given one word, which we refer to as the prime, and a second word, which we're referring to as the target, requires actually quite a complex process. At the very least, first thing you need to do is register the information in a phonological input store, so remember it in phonological memory, both the prime and the target. Then you need to do some process of phonemic segmentation and deletion. So you need to take off that word-ending sound of the prime and take off that word-ending sound of the target. And then you need to compare those word-ending sounds. And then you need to execute a decision and make a response. So for behavioral studies of auditory rhyming with adults, about the best you're going to get is the execution of decision and response, that last step. So an adult can tell you something about the process that they went to make the decision that two words rhymed or did not rhyme, and you'll have the response data. For the age range we're looking at, 6 to 8-year-old kids, the best you're going to get is the response. If you try to ask a 6-year-old child, so you say, what was your thinking about that? Why did you decide that those two words rhymed? You're just not going to get any useful data. So what's out there for this age range, for the 6 to 8-year-old age range, is basically response data. And we don't really have any idea of what's going on in the brain. And our hope was that we'd actually get some indices of these previous steps by looking at brainwave data. So we had done a study using rhyming words, real words, like moose and juice or moose and chair. And what we were looking for was some ERP index of encoding the prime in phonological memory and some ERP index of the matching or mismatching of the prime and the target. And what we found was a very large, prominent rising negativity to primes, which is referred to in the literature as the CNV, and that non-rhyming targets elicit a more negative response than rhyming targets do, so we have a rhyming effect to targets using real-word stimuli. And this is actually a study that looked at this simple paradigm from age 7 to 25 plus, the graduate student age range. This rhyming effect was the same across from 6 to 35. Same response, same timing across all the age groups.
The coding there is mixed up a little bit. The one that's showing the late negativity is the non-rhyming, right?
Oh, this disappeared. Sorry about that. This is non-rhymes. This is rhymes.
Okay.
And then the difference between them is what we're calling the rhyming effect. Sorry about that. Lost my blue line. So for this current study with the 6 to 8-year-old kids, we actually upped the ante a little bit and used non-words as stimuli. So nin, rin versus nin, vu. And we did this to abstract any semantic information. So there's no semantic bootstrapping going on here. We've got really a better index of phonological processing. And we also did it because people are in Helen Neville's lab are very interested in using this paradigm with really little kids and seeing when do you see the onset of this response. We know it's there in 6-year-olds, but how low can you go? So we took out the semantic information to make everybody on even ground, basically. And again, we were looking for that CNV to primes and the rhyming effect to targets, now with these non-word stimuli. And we did find the rising negativity to primes, and we found that the latency of that rising negativity was related to development across the 6 to 8-year-old age range. So it's latest in our 6-year-olds and earliest in our 8-year-olds. So you're actually getting faster at putting that information into phonological memory. Looking at the rhyming effect, we see the same pattern that we saw with real words with non-words. We see that non-rhyming targets in the blue are more negative than rhyming targets in the purple. The rhyming effect is there, just the way it was with real words. This time, however, we had some behavioral data on these kids. We had a huge battery of behavioral tests for these kids, but we had one of those was the Comprehensive Test of Phonological Processing, the CTOP, and we used the Phonological Awareness Composite Score from that test to see what we could find in terms of this rhyming effect. The timing of the rhyming effect, the time at which these two conditions diverged, was related to phonological awareness. So we did another median split, high on phonological awareness, low on phonological awareness. And what we find is that the effect onsets earliest in our highest phonological awareness kids, and the difference was 80 milliseconds, which might not seem like a lot of time in the real world, but in ERP land, that's a huge difference. If you think that back to the sentence data and think those conditions diverge for that in-context complex semantic processing by 300 milliseconds already, 80 milliseconds is big.
Do you have any information about what their standard scores were on the phonological lens composite, splitting the high and low scores?
I do. I don't know it offhand, but I have it's submitted to JOCN, and I have the paper here on my laptop, so I can look it up for you.
Okay.
Other questions? So this is where ERPs become important, this timing issue, this automaticity issue, the connection between behavior and brain data. Just to summarize where we've been today, what is the psycholinguistic theory behind learning to read? We want to focus on orthography, phonology, and automaticity. Those are the key concepts in beginning reading. How do neurocognitive language systems develop in terms of the N400? Those were the early studies. It's clear that the fledgling word processing system is less selective. It's letting all sorts of strings in as if they should undergo word processing. And we have evidence of brain behavior connections. So our high-ability first-grade readers show an N400, and our low-ability readers show little N400 activity. But we also have evidence of brain behavior disconnections. Our 10- and 11-year-old readers who looked fluent behaviorally, when you look at their brains are not doing adult-like processing. How do ERPs to reading-related processes develop? Well, we have a couple of clues. We can get some information from theories of atypical language and reading development. It implicates specific systems. When we look at those specific systems, we find indeed that the motion processing or magnocellular system does lag in development in comparison to the color processing system and is still developing across the 6 to 8-year-old learning to read age range. We find that rapid processing of speech sounds doesn't show too much development, at least in terms of our paradigms, but that non-speech, fast auditory temporal processing doesn't look adult-like in 6 to 8-year-olds. Finally, we see evidence that phonological memory is developing across the 6 to 8-year-old age range, at least in terms of the timing of remembering phonological information. And we see that phonological matching at first glance does not seem to be developing. The ability seems to be there by age 6. It looks adult-like. It looks the same as a 7-year-old, the same as an 8-year-old. But when you look more closely, you see that phonological matching, the timing of that effect, is related to behavioral ability in terms of phonological awareness. So where to go from here? What does happen in the brain as children learn how to read? We've got some really tantalizing clues here, but we don't have a clear answer to what's going on in the brain. We need some more studies of reading, ERP studies of reading, fMRI studies of reading, looking both at single word processing, which I've mostly been talking about here, and going into sentence studies. Kids are reading words in sentences. There's a lot of contextual clues, a lot of semantic information, and we need to understand how that system interacts with these developing phonological and orthographic systems. We need to look more closely at orthography, phonology, and automaticity. What do these concepts really mean? What's involved in phonology? What's involved in orthography? So we've started that a little bit by looking at this motion processing system, but there's got to be more to it than that. So we need to unpack these ideas. We need to keep making connections with specific behavioral evidence. So there really should not be any ERP studies out there that only have brain data. Everybody should be collecting behavioral data at the same time. We need to make connections across these two fields, which shouldn't even be two fields. They shouldn't be two separate things. They should be the same thing. You always need the behavioral data to ground you so that you know what's going on. And finally, the whole point of all of this research is to apply it to something useful. And in this case, it basically applies both to intervention and to education at a basic level. So we're talking about 7% of kindergarten children having SLI and 10% and in some estimates up to 30% of school-aged children having dyslexia. So this kind of information is relevant to a lot of kids and a lot of teachers. Another issue in education, very hot right now, especially in Massachusetts, is bilingualism. So, oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to ask how, maybe you said that in the beginning, but how do you differentiate between SLI and dyslexia?
So SLI is a specific language impairment. It has to do with spoken language, and dyslexia has to do with written language. And you can have SLI and dyslexia at the same time. Many cases of SLI develop into cases of dyslexia when kids hit first grade because in order to learn how to read, you need to have mastered the phonology. And SLI kids have spoken language deficits, so they haven't mastered the phonology. So it shows up as dyslexia once you get into the reading grades.
Is one of the main symptoms of SLI a delay in language acquisition?
They usually are late talkers, like 95% or something like that are late talkers. So we need to look not only at what's happening when a brain is learning to read one language, but what if a brain already has two spoken languages? What if the phonology is very different than the phonology of the written language? What if the phonology is very similar to the phonology of the written language? And there's virtually no brain research out there on this issue, and it would be relatively easy to do. It's just out there waiting, needing to be done. And that's the same case when you look at educational techniques. So what I've been talking about today is a phonics approach to reading, focusing on phonology and orthography and those lower level processes. There's a whole other approach to teaching reading that focuses on meaning and the semantics and context. And clearly something different is going to be going on in the brains of children who are focused on semantics and meaning versus children who are focused on phonology and orthography. And again, there's virtually no research out there, and this is an empirical question just waiting to be answered. It's clear overall that it's not enough anymore just to look at the neuroscience or just to look at the behavior. We need to tie everything together. We need to make connections across brain, behavior, mind, education in order to understand what's happening with reading and what's happening in a number of other domains. Thank you. Other questions?
I wonder if you're far enough along in thinking about this to give anything like a short paragraph summary of what you think, how you think this might all fit together in terms of processing of language. I know there's so many pieces.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to keep them all in my mind.
The studies that I've been doing with the 6 to 8 year olds. Were not what I wanted to do, but needed to be done in order to establish the quote-unquote, you know, normal, typical course of development of ERPs for these specific paradigms. Now the next step is to go back and run these paradigms with SLI and dyslexic kids and see if the brain evidence will support the behavioral evidence. Are we going to see a magnocellular deficit in a dyslexic child? I don't know because the study hasn't been done, and I needed to do this first so that I would have a comparison to know what's going on in the normal 6-year-old.
I think it's great research. I'm just, wondering how you see it in terms of supporting a model of normal development of language and meaning.
Right now,
really the answer.
I think it does speak to that. Okay. Right now, I've jumped around from the early N400 studies that are looking at this higher integration process, and now I'm all the way back down to basic visual processing. And at some point in time, those are going to collapse. And, you know, there are the studies that I've talked about today and virtually nothing else out there. So as the holes keep getting filled in and I do more and more studies and other people start doing this kind of research, I believe that we're going to have a story from basic visual auditory processes all the way up to higher level integration processing, and we will have a brain and behavior story of beginning reading.
So like one dimension of that story will be something about processes that are pretty that are mature pretty early versus processes that take a longer time.
Right, exactly. What is already established by the time you start learning to read? So you would guess that maybe some of the spoken language processing things would be pretty well established by 5 or 6 years of age. And indeed, our MMN research suggests that the speech processing is pretty good. And it's the non-speech processing that's still developing. So that kind of information can come from studies like this. What's there, what's the foundation, and what are you building on it to get to the ability to read?
Okay. Ages ago when you were here, you pointed to, out to me some literature that showed that there seemed to be a difference between the hemispheres, some changes in hemispheric involvement in this early development of reading.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't say anything about the hemispheric differences here.
I don't have results to support hemispheric differences right now.
So basically you're not finding any so far.
I'm not finding any. I'm recording with 32, the 6 to 8 year olds was 32 electrodes. The early N400 studies was 16 electrodes. I wouldn't want to say anything from 16. And I'd be a little worried about making hemispheric claims on 32. So spatially, I don't think ERPs are going to tell us very much about where things are going on. But the strength, from my view, for this beginning reader research is that it can give you the temporal information. It can tell you about automaticity.
So you think you might need a pent-up MRI or something else?
Yeah, we're going to have to put 7-year-olds in the magnet sooner or later. Yeah.
I was wondering, I was trying to figure out how you can tease apart the difference between the effects that learning to read has on these processes versus the normal development of these processes and how they might be related to reading.
Right.
And I was wondering what you think about a design in which you test kids at the beginning of first grade, and some kids walk into first grade and they can read,
right,
and some kids can't, and then actually follow them over the course of that year and see if, you know, beginning, middle, end point, if you actually saw different developmental pathways based on beginning readers versus kids who could read already versus who couldn't.
Yeah, that would be amazing. And longitudinal studies are basically, you know, the goal of all developmental research, whether you're doing, you know, ERPs or behavioral research. One of the problems with ERP research is that you have a repetition effect, a known repetition effect. And whether that would come into play from September to January to June has never been studied. So within a study, we know we have a repetition effect. If you keep showing the same word over and over again, the response diminishes to almost nothing. A study 1 week and a study next week, you have diminished responses to the same stimuli. But I don't know of any studies looking at this long-term stuff. So there'd have to be a lot of groundwork with adults first to see what do ERPs look like in a longitudinal design.
Would it work to do cross-sectional, like beginning kindergarten, beginning first, beginning second, or something like that?
That would probably be easier, but there's so much individual difference.
Right.
The waveforms of these kids are all over the place. So I'll show you, you know, the grand average of the MMN, and some of the kids had an MMP. But it just averages out over all of the kids that it's an MMN response. And
another great topic for
future, so. Yeah. What was it about those kids that showed, you know, a really small response or a backwards response? And unfortunately, the ERP method is such that you have to average across people. The technology, you just can't look at an individual subject pretty much. And that might be changing. People are working on methods to make it possible to look at individuals.
Could
ERP
you really
waveforms.
Say, you know, thousands of trials for the individual?
You could do it. But if you're going to have thousands of trials, they need to be short, really short. And they need to be repeated. So you get this repetition effect problem again.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's not the best method to use, but for questions like this, at this level, when you need something that tells you about automaticity, it's the best thing out there, by far.
Does MEG require fewer trials, or does it require just as many?
MEG requires just as many trials, and it's even more sensitive to movement. Mm. And it's very costly, very expensive.
Yes. Not so expensive as MRI, right?
It's getting up there for some of the really, okay, yeah, top systems. You can easily spend $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, if a kid yanks our cap or, you know, something, does something to our cap, okay, so, you know, it's $700. We'll have to get a new cap. If a kid knocks their head into the magnetometer, that's $1 million you just lost. You can't fix it. So there aren't a lot of kids' studies using MED. There's, you know, one or two labs out there that have come up with techniques that they think work. But it's hard to do any of this neuroscience research with kids because all of the methods have very specific limitations. And it's sort of like, you know, if you could put all the methods together into one somehow, right, it would be ideal.
You can do that with adults, but it's really hard to do it with kids.
Yeah.
And is there any other technique that has the temporal discrimination capacity of EEG and MEG?
NERS is getting there, near infrared spectroscopy. Most of the studies have been with, it's very new, most of the studies have been with adults and with infants. I've looked at some of those reports. I don't know what they're looking at in their waveforms. I wish someone who did ERP or EEG research would do NERS research and really try to make a connection between the two things, because you get waveforms that kind of look similar, but they're saying something entirely different. It's based on blood flow, not electricity.
Well, if it's blood flow, then it can't get the fast response, right?
They claim that it has better temporal specificity than fMRI. I'm not convinced. There are, you know, a handful of studies out there, and I'm really not convinced. I think you can get better spatial information. It is a lot more simple than fMRI. So if we had the, say, hemispheric question, it would be relatively easy to use a NERS system after we ran these kids in an ERPS system and get that spatial information. Other questions? Comments?
I have a basic level comment that I haven't really formulated it well, but excuse me if I missed it. But I was just sort of struck by the fact, because I was thinking about those results of the beep, 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 boop, beep,
yep,
kind of the odd paradox.
Yeah.
That if those are the processes that sort of don't develop, at least during early childhood, right? And those are also the ones that are the most basic processes that you have problems with in dyslexia from the behavioral data.
Mm-hmm.
Then it just really struck me as to why it's so difficult to remediate dyslexia if it's processes that don't develop that we have to work on.
Right. I think the story is that the deficit occurs prenatally with brain development at a very basic level. And so it's there from birth, and you only see the effects of it once you start to learn how to read. So systems like Fast Forward are designed to specifically remediate this fast auditory temporal processing deficit. And their basic claim is that they're retraining neurons within this auditory system to process information faster by first slowing it down a lot and then incrementally speeding it up. So they allow kids to hear a difference that they've never heard before, and then they incrementally move them back to normal, quote-unquote, speech. Whether that's actually happening or not, I don't know.
It's just interesting to know that they're trying to change a system that normally doesn't change. So it's not like you've got a system that's a little bit different from the start, and then as it develops, it goes off.
Right.
it's actually staying the same different the whole time, and it's not meant to change. So
right.
You've got an extra obstacle.
Well, yeah, no, this is true. These are 6 to 8-year-olds. I don't know what happens birth to 5. There are a lot of MMN studies with infants that say, look, it's there, you know, it doesn't change. If we use these exact stimuli with those infants, I don't know what we would get. So it's, you know, again, you want to do a cross-sectional study with the same stimuli and see what the response is. There might be some evidence of development early, which would suggest that the system is more plastic and, you know, maybe you're outside the critical period, but the window is still open. Yeah?
With that fast-forward system,
yeah.
Was it effective? Was it found to be effective?
Well, it depends on who you're asking.
Okay.
There are the two original reports in Science from Paula Talal and Mike Mersnick in 96. And that's pretty much the only published research out there. There have been case studies. A name you want to look for is Ron Gillum. Mark Fay is involved in some of this research. Case studies suggesting that there are changes, but that they're not any better or any bigger than standard language therapies. And in fact, when you look at the figures in those original studies and the text, actually, it says all of the kids improved significantly. It was just that the fast-forward kids improved more, which would suggest that it's not the slowing down of the speech that's the magic bullet.
Those were also language-like kids, not dyslexic kids, right?
These were language-impaired kids, never defined, LI kids.
Okay.
Yeah, what that means, you know, language-learning impaired, language-impaired, what that means is unclear.
Okay, Tommy had to go. She was involved with studies at MGH on this. From my understanding is that they found no behavioral effects from fast forward.
Lots of people are finding either very small or no behavioral effects, except for tasks that are similar to the fast forward games. So, like the token test, where you're asked to follow directions and move figures and move objects around, you know, put the green square on the red circle. That's basically one of the games in Fast Forward. You've been doing it for 6 weeks intensively, 3 hours a day, every day after school. Clearly, you're going to get better at that task. If you use standardized measures of language and reading development, language, sometimes you find some developmental differences post and pre. Reading development, almost no one finds differences.
Nevertheless, it's being marketed as an intervention for kids with dyslexia.
Oh, no.
Energetically.
Dyslexia, autism,
right.
you know, nonverbal learning disorder. I mean, your child has any problem, fast forward, we'll fix it.
And they didn't use any fMRI studies to support
autism? There is a recent, Elise Temple, yes, just came out with PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences article, fMRI study using fast forward. I don't find it convincing. But they're trying to do, I mean, they are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to get the data to support their claims. It would have been nice to have the data first before they made the claims, but they are trying to go back and get the data. So far, I'm not convinced.
Okay.